Thank you very much for the generous words and for the warm welcome. It's good to be back. I have been at all these symposia, and the feeling in the room today is different from the one we had at the beginning, as I know from personal experience. Are disabled people fit to participate in the broad range of activities that other people can enjoy? Do disabled people have the same level of legal protection that others can expect? Is the value represented by those with disabilities recognized within the law? What has the Supreme Court said? In the Federalist Papers, number 78, Alexander Hamilton offered the opinion that among the branches of government, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution. Was Alexander Hamilton correct about the constitutional protections provided to people with disabilities? What does the record disclose? Disability is a challenge to the judiciary. What is disability? And why is the subject such a hardship to the judges? People with disabilities are unable to hear, or speak, or see, or walk, or lift, or communicate, or manage daily activities without uncommon emotional or mental reaction, or a combination of these traits. Because most judges do not have experience with these conditions, the concept of a requirement that equality before the law must be maintained becomes a challenge. Most of the judges do not know what to do, and faced with uncertainty, they retreat into the protection of ancient precedent and equally ancient thought. Perhaps some of this thinking comes from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who published the Common Law in 1881, commenting on a passage in the book G. Edward White, synthesized one thought from the Common Law as follows. Blameworthiness in determining liability for tort was ascribed to a person who fell below the standard of care ascribed to the average man, the man with ordinary intelligence and prudence. If a person did not possess the same characteristics as this hypothetical average man, sometimes that fact was taken into account. Blind persons, infants, and on some occasions, insane persons were presumed not to be capable of meeting a standard of average care for themselves or others. Such a statement declares without demonstration that the law is firmly convinced, presumptively, that at least two categories of disability render individuals incapable of meeting an ordinary standard of care. No matter how demanding the challenge of equality for all may be, however, the courts must meet it. This is the purpose for which they were established. The Declaration of Independence contains the famous assertion that all men are created equal. As Dr. Jacobus Tenbrook, in whose name we conduct this law symposium, observed, this is not a declaratory statement, but an imperative one. Before the law, all are equal, and the demand is that the judges make decisions to support this fundamental requirement. However, if those possessing disability are incapable of meeting an ordinary standard of care, how can equality be achieved? In 1927, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote one of the worst decisions ever adopted by the Supreme Court of the United States, Buck versus Bell. In that case, a woman allegedly disabled challenged the right of the state of Virginia to sterilize her based solely on the assertion that she was feeble-minded. Justice Holmes said that Virginia could take this action without violating any constitutional principle as long as it did so in accordance with legal processes established by the state. Justice Holmes is remembered today as a brilliant and progressive thinker, but this decision does not exemplify either brilliance or progressiveness. In 1924, the Virginia legislature adopted a law authorizing forced sterilization for inmates of the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded in instances in which the health of the patient or the welfare of society may be promoted. By the fall of the same year, the colony had decided that Carrie Buck was feeble-minded, that she was the child of a feeble-minded mother, and that her newborn infant was also feeble-minded. Carrie Buck was without a supportive family. Prior to being placed in the institution for epileptics and feeble-minded, she had been sent to perform domestic service for a family, one of whose members apparently raped her. The institutionalization at the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded seems to have been the method used by the family to get Carrie Buck out of the way. Carrie Buck's daughter was born in 1924 and was determined by officials at the colony to be a feeble-minded child. At the age of 7 months, these officials looked at the newborn and, without more, decided she possessed a mental disability. The superintendent of the colony decided that Carrie Buck should be sterilized. By the spring of 1927, less than 3 years later, the Carrie Buck case was before the Supreme Court. When I thought about this case, I wondered what could possibly have happened. A person who has been placed in an institution alleged to possess mental disability at the age of 18 does not ordinarily have financial resources, specialized training, or political connections that make the appeals process readily available. How could Carrie Buck have managed to get her case before the highest court in the land? A review of the record shows that the lawyer representing Carrie Buck had previously been one of the directors of the institution where she had been confined. The record also indicates that he never called Carrie Buck to testify on her own behalf, and he never called other witnesses to testify for her. Furthermore, the superintendent of the institution where she was confined paid the bill for the lawyer purportedly representing Carrie Buck. She never had independent counsel, and she never got her day in court. I reached the conclusion that the government officials responsible for the operation of the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded wanted to test the constitutionality of the law, and they decided to use Carrie Buck for their experiment. In the Buck versus Bell decision, Justice Holmes said, "There can be no doubt that so far as procedure is concerned, the rights of the patient are most carefully considered. The plaintiff in error has had due process at law." Did Justice Holmes know what had actually taken place? Did he examine the record to determine if it had been thoroughly made? Did he note the absence of testimony from the person whose rights were being challenged? Did it cross his mind to wonder how a person alleged to possess mental disability could have managed to obtain independent counsel to present her case? Did he wonder about the tests used to determine the facts? Did he give consideration to the status of the petitioner, who was a minor during these proceedings? The decision of the court does not say. What Justice Holmes did say is that disabled people sap the strength of the state, and that having more of them would cause the people of the state to be swamped with incompetence. He also declared that Carrie Buck is the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring, and that if she were not sterilized, she would need to be confined. Imprisonment or sterilization, those are the choices. The decision declares that Carrie Buck has received procedural due process, despite the flimsiness of the record, that she is not entitled to any substantive due process, and that she is not protected by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Carrie Buck is declared to be a positive danger to the state of Virginia because she possesses a disability which may be inheritable. State action is based upon the purported urgency to protect the state against the positive danger she represents. Although it has been criticized, this decision has never been explicitly reversed. The statute authorizing sterilization for the disabled remained on the books until the 1970s. In 1942, in a case entitled Skinner versus Oklahoma, the Supreme Court once again contemplated involuntary sterilization, this time addressing habitual criminal behavior. A person convicted of crime involving moral turpitude on more than two occasions might be sterilized to prevent the inheritance of this trait by future generations. A unanimous court determined that the crimes for which sterilization were authorized were not distinguishable from other crimes and declared the statute unconstitutional as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. However, Mr. Justice Douglas, who delivered the opinion of the court, revisited the Buck versus Bell case without reversing. 36 years after the Skinner case, the Supreme Court reviewed still another case dealing with sterilization and disability. In Stump versus Sparkman, the plaintiff, Linda K. Sparkman, challenged actions of a judge who had ordered her sterilization. Linda Sparkman's mother filed an ex parte petition declaring that her daughter, then aged 15, was somewhat retarded and was exhibiting questionable behavior. Although no state law authorized the action, the judge signed the petition without proceedings. Linda Sparkman was sent to the hospital for the sterilization operation, having been led to believe that she would be having an appendectomy. The doctor didn't tell her. Hospital staff didn't tell her. Her mother didn't tell her. And the judge didn't tell her the truth. She learned of the sterilization only later, when she married and sought to bear children. The decision of the Supreme Court, written by Mr. Justice White, held that judicial immunity prevented the recovery of damage. A judge acting in the capacity of a judge may not be subjected to claims for damage. The dissenting opinion observed that the judge had not acted as a judge. The judicial system is intended to be adversarial, not to operate as an ex parte process in which the assertions of one party can be unchallenged. Judicial proceedings are expected to have parties with the right to testify and to present witnesses, with the opportunity to cross-examine those presenting hostile testimony, with the right to know what proceedings are intended to be pursued, with the right to independent, aggressive counsel, with the right to challenge the facts as presented, and with the right to appeal in case of an adverse ruling. None of these rights were observed. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court held that the action of the judge was taken in his capacity as a judicial officer and that judicial immunity applied. Could this action have been taken against any girl or any woman in the state? Was the reason behind the decision that Linda Sparkman, a child, was somewhat retarded? Is there any other justification? In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was adopted, which invokes the Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment as the constitutional authority being exercised by Congress for the statute. In 2001, in Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama versus Garrett, the Supreme Court found that Title I of the Act does not authorize damage claims against a state government because this is prohibited by the 11th Amendment, despite language in the Act saying that the 11th Amendment is abrogated. The court said that permissible legislation to redress a harm must address a pattern of discrimination proscribed by the 14th Amendment and must have congruence and proportionality in the remedy to address the harm. The court believed that Congress had not demonstrated this pattern and that Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act does not have the necessary congruence. Chief Justice Rehnquist, who delivered the opinion of the court, said, states are not required by the 14th Amendment to make special accommodations for the disabled so long as their actions toward such individuals are rational. They could quite hard-headedly and perhaps hard-heartedly hold to job qualification requirements which do not make allowance for the disabled. Why did the Chief Justice think it worth referring to the feelings of state government officials when interpreting civil rights legislation? Does the Chief Justice believe that participation by disabled people is only a matter of charity? Is it the law that other people may expect protection as the law is written, but disabled people may be permitted to participate in government actions if the hearts of those who control the government are right? This language is offensive on many levels. The Chief Justice also said it would be entirely reasonable and therefore constitutional for a state employer to conserve scarce financial resources by hiring employees who are able to use existing facilities. The accommodation duty far exceeds what is constitutionally required in that it makes unlawful a range of alternative responses that would be reasonable. Is this statement clear? Does it not say that making the full range of employment opportunities available to people with disabilities demands what is not reasonable? Does it not say that the Americans with Disabilities Act is itself unreasonable? Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act impermissibly expanded constitutional protection for the disabled, said the court. 3 years later, in Tennessee versus Lane, a challenge by plaintiffs with orthopedic disabilities under Title II of the ADA was upheld on the grounds that the coverage of Title II was a proportional remedy seeking to redress a harm which consisted of a pattern of discrimination by state government in providing services. The Garrett case involved a nurse who had been employed by a state hospital. When she contracted cancer and asked for accommodations, she was informed upon her return to work that her former position was no longer available to her and that she must accept a lesser one. The Lane case dealt with plaintiffs who had been accused of crime and who were expected, despite their inability to walk, to make their way to a courtroom on the second floor of a courthouse that did not possess an elevator. In the Garrett case, the pattern of discrimination was not discernible to Chief Justice Rehnquist, and the congruence did not exist. In the Lane case, the pattern of discrimination was evident to Justice Stevens, and the congruence was also plain. Justice Souter, in the Lane case, in a concurring opinion, offered a critical observation about Buck versus Bell. These are the words from the concurring opinion. Evidence of a pattern of discrimination against the disabled would show that the judiciary itself has endorsed the basis for some of the very discrimination subject to congressional remedy under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Buck versus Bell was not grudging in sustaining the constitutionality of the once pervasive practice of involuntarily sterilizing those with mental disabilities. The decision at page 207 says in part, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." Three generations of imbeciles are enough. Although the Buck versus Bell decision has never been explicitly reversed, it has been criticized sufficiently, even by the Supreme Court, that the force of the decision is largely gone. As Chief Judge Merritt of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals observed in Feger versus Thomas, virtually all of the Buck versus Bell decision has been abandoned. In 1927, the Buck versus Bell case stood for the proposition that eugenics was incorporated in the American judicial system. Government could take action to seek to purify the human race, and disabled people could be treated as a subclass or a subspecies of that race. In 1982, a child was born in Indiana who was diagnosed with Down syndrome and other correctable ailments. The correctable ailments prevented the child from eating or drinking. Acting in accordance with the advice of their doctor, the parents of this child decided not to correct those ailments. 6 days after being born, the child died of starvation and dehydration. Following the death of this child, the Department of Health and Human Services adopted regulations pursuant to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, directing hospitals to take steps to assure that non-discrimination is a policy followed by the hospitals in rendering medical care to disabled children. In 1986, the Supreme Court considered a challenge to these regulations in Bowen versus American Hospital Association. The court ruled that a child with a disability is not a qualified individual seeking the protection of Section 504 in the provision of medical services if the parents have not granted consent to the treatment. The relationship between parent and child and the determination of medical services to be provided to children are traditionally matters for state authority. Apparently, if the states want to protect the lives of disabled children, they may do so. The federal government will not act affirmatively to assure that disability cannot be used to deny life-saving medical treatment. Of course, the eugenics movement of today does not ordinarily make life and death decisions about human beings already born. The decisions about infants with disabilities are made before birth, and the advice is often to terminate a pregnancy that might produce children with disabilities. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, formerly known by other names, was adopted by Congress almost half a century ago. This was beneficial because it declared that children with disabilities could receive an education. Since then, the question has been, what kind of an education? An equal educational opportunity is not required by the Act, said the Supreme Court, as long as educational benefits are being provided. How many educational benefits? As the Supreme Court pointed out in the Andrew case, some courts thought the standard should be merely more than de minimis. A substantially equal educational opportunity is not required by IDEA, but an appropriately challenging one is, said the court, when reversing the merely more than de minimis standard. The promise of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act is restored by the court. The act is not intended just to get disabled students out of the house and into the school. When they are at school, the teachers must seek to educate them. What does all of this mean for us? At the outset, those who participate get to be an element of the group that sets the agenda. What people with disabilities declare is this: we will be in the room. We will be among those in the halls of power. We will be part of the group gathered around the table for decision. As Dr. Jacobus Tenbrook said in 1957, we are citizens of the United States now and are now, not merely in some future generation, possessed of the right to be citizens and share the privileges, immunities, and responsibilities of that status. Moreover, the bounty of the Constitution extends to all persons, whether citizens or not, rights to freedom, equality, and individuality. As citizens, then, or as persons who happen to be deprived of one of their physical senses, we claim under the broad protection of the Constitution the right to life, personal freedom, personal security, the right to marry, have, and rear children, and to maintain a home, and the right, so far as government can ensure it, to fair opportunity to earn a livelihood which will make these other rights possible and significant. This prophecy, expressed by Dr. Jacobus Tenbrook 60 years ago, will come true. With the coming of the Americans with Disabilities Act, disability cases have appeared more often in the federal courts than in previous times. But the number of these is still tiny. The judges routinely employ stereotypical thinking to make decisions with respect to the rights of disabled people. They often possess not just limited comprehension of the capacity of the disabled, but a distorted understanding. This means that more cases must be brought with more knowledgeable advocates, advocates such as the people in this room and others that we can recruit. We must also seek positions on the bench. In the past, disability denoted failure or worse. Parents who found themselves with disabled children wondered what they had done wrong, who was in the family had sinned, what fatal flaw in our makeup caused this tragedy. Then they wondered, who will care for this child when I cannot? Disability signified blame and shame. Too many judges believe this still, and it is our job to change it. Disability does not signify that those who share this designation are unfit to participate fully as integrated members of society. It does not mean those who possess such characteristics are abnormal or unnatural. Disability is part of our culture, and it always has been. Those who possess these traits have value, and we demand that it be recognized and that our opportunities be expanded in accordance with this recognition. The battle may occur on the streets, in the halls of Congress, in the courtrooms of the land. The challenge before us is enormous, and the details are legion. But we have the courage, and we can find the strength. 90 years after the Supreme Court told us our rights could be dismissed out of hand, we have made a decision, and we will not be dissuaded. We will enter the Supreme Court building. We will be within the chamber, and some of us will be welcomed on the bench. That's what we say. Well, it's good to be back. We've got a lot to cover. And I want our next panel to come, if you would. I've been talking about the 14th Amendment, and I don't know what these folks are going to say, but we're now going to talk about the unequal application of it. We have two extraordinary human beings to tell us more about this topic and to The subject of what's wrong with it is pretty fairly easily described, or at least I think it is. The subject that is fascinating and one I very much look forward to hearing from you folks is what to do about it. So we have Samuel Bagenstos, who is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. He has been part of the Department of Justice. I don't think they want you back right now, Sam. And he's been a litigator on the subject of disability and equal rights for disabled people and minority groups. And he's had a long career of it, but a very recent win in the Supreme Court, which maybe you'll cover. I left it out of what I was doing, but it's so recent that I'm not sure the law reports have caught up with it yet. And then we have Sylvia Yee, who is Senior Staff Attorney of Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and I've looked at your bios, both of you, and I could read them, but you would like to have something to say this morning, I bet. So how about if we let you folks have at it for a bit, and then we'll see if we have time for some questions. Which of you will begin?
Okay, I guess I will.
Sam? Very well.